And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is an all-purpose edition of the Wild Side News. It's an action-packed update covering everything from the wars between butterflies and off-roaders to the raiders of the whale refuge in the Arctic waters south of Australia to the snow-laden trails that await your footsteps as we cover the globe to bring you the most significant stories making the news this week in the realms of nature. It's all coming up when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What a difference a year makes. I've been updating the archives, and I've got some great news about that, which I'll tell you a little later, but it was just about a year ago that I was reporting on the aftermath of the tsunami and wondered aloud if 2005 was going to be the year of the weather story. Well, it certainly was that. And 2006 may continue to bring us drama from the weather fronts. Already, the storms that have battered Northern California may be setting the stage for yet another difficult change in the weather. But if I had to make a prediction about where the most dramatic stories about nature and the environment will occur in 2006, the story of what's happening as we speak down in the Arctic Ocean may sound the clarion call about the year ahead. We'll be talking with Paul Watson, captain of the Farley Mowat, who is using his boat to literally chase away various Japanese whaling ships which have been whaling in the Arctic whale refuge south of Australia. We'll get to the breaking story via satellite phone from him following the news in this first segment. Then in segment two, winter is a time when heading off onto the snow-laden trails can bring some very special rewards. We talk with Seth Levy of American Hiking Society about how to prepare for and enjoy this special winter sport. And then, in our third segment, we hear from Karen Schombach, who is trying to get the federal government to carry out its obligations to protect endangered species. In this case, it's the story of the Sand Mountain Blue Butterfly, which is being run over, literally, by people on off-road vehicles. We learn from this story where protective powers are headed. It's a future you need to be aware of. So, there's something for everyone, which we will get right into following this week's Nature News. So now, the news. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service initiated a public debate on Monday over its plan to lift federal protections from grizzly bears in the Yellowstone National Park area, a measure that would open the hunting of bears in surrounding western states. The number of grizzlies has grown in the last 30 years from 136 to more than 600, which now have spread into the land surrounding the Great Yellowstone Park. The presence of the large bears, which are a main attraction in the national park, is considered a nuisance to some in the outlying communities, and the claim that the bears' attraction to livestock raises the customary complaint that they are interfering with ranchers' livelihoods. Opposing the proposed hunting seasons are the regular defenders, such as the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Sierra Club. The stories of the success of wildlife management over the years, are now turning into the nightmare of witnessing the shooting of the animals so many have worked so hard to keep from vanishing. It is a story to be retold thousands of times in the years ahead. Look at a similar story with a different ending. Wildlife officials at the Yellowstone National Park have expressed concerns that the deaths of the majority of gray wolf pups might be due to a dog disease. Only about 22 wolf pups survived out of the 69 that were born in the park in 2005, said Doug Smith, who heads Yellowstone's Wolf Project. Last year's figures of the pups' survival are a record low in the 11-year history of the wolf's reintroduction to the park. The deaths are suspected to be due to the parvovirus, which leads to severe diarrhea and dehydration in the infected animal. While adults can withstand these stresses, young pups generally cannot. In the Yellowstone Park's northern region, as many as 41 pups out of the 49 born succumbed to the disease last spring, while the Leopold pack showed only 2 pups surviving from the 19 born. Strategies to counter these effects are being proposed, but vaccinations to prevent parvovirus would require 2 injections of every wolf. The likelihood of success in such an undertaking is questionable. Zoos across America are debating whether elephants are really capable of healthy captivity on a long-term basis. Such has caused the Pittsburgh Zoo to purchase a former hunting ranch to house a new conservation center to breed African elephants. The 700-acre center could later include cheetahs, black rhinoceros, and Grevy's zebras, but the biggest portion of the former Glen Savage Ranch would be dedicated to the pachyderms. Problems with caring for pachyderms have led 5 zoos, including those in Chicago, San Francisco, and Detroit, to discontinue their elephant exhibits. About 40 other zoos are expanding their exhibits to meet the standards set out by the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. You might want to grab a quick peek at your local pachyderm before they get packed up and transported to Pittsburgh. A federal judge who struck down a Bush administration decision to ease logging restrictions last summer issued an injunction Monday blocking as many as 144 timber sales in 3 states. The timber sales in Washington, Oregon, and California had been approved under the administration's decision to stop requiring that the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management look for and protect rare plants and animals before logging on the 505 million acres covered by the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan. Judge Marsha Peckman, in her decision Monday, wrote that the potential harm to the approximately 300 species protected by the old rule outweighed the potential harm to the government. Total income to the government from the sales was projected to be $2.7 million. The courts have again had to force the Forest Service to use science rather than politics and favoritism to preserve our last remaining old-growth forests, said Pete Frost, attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center in Eugene, Oregon. No acreage figure was immediately available, but the 144 timber sales totaled 289 million board feet, more than half the amount logged under the Northwest Forest Plan in 2004. And that's the news. And now, a few reminders. The most important news is that the Wildside News archives are essentially updated, which means that for those of you who have visited the archives to find a notice that this file cannot be found, will instead be once again listening to your Voices of the Earth. Please, if you find errors, let us know by sending an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. Thanks for your patience. Nature is making news every day, from the threats of global warming and the wreckage of weather to the breakthroughs in animal communication to what many are now referring to as the beginning of the next mass extinction. The passions to protect life on planet Earth are rising, and with such, the commitments to take increasingly direct action to protect the defenseless. This past week witnessed what may become the nature of nature news in the new year. It's the story of new resistance to the wanton taking of the animals. Some would call it greed, and many will say, it's killing the planet. As the passions rise, so too the battle lines. In the Arctic seas south of Australia, large boats are beginning to smash into one another over the issue of the future of whales on planet Earth. And now joining us from the Arctic Ocean is the captain of the Farley Moat, which is a vessel that travels the world working to really stand in defense and a guardian for the wild creatures and nature itself. Paul Watson, welcome to the Wildside News.
Well, thank you.
There are big stories happening, and you're right in the middle of it. Give us a heads up on what's happening down there.
Well, right now we're at the very bottom of the Indian Ocean, right in the middle, halfway between Perth and Cape Town, and we're pursuing the Japanese whaling fleet. They're running to the west, and they've been running since Sunday. We've caught up with them 3 times since December 21st. Every time we catch up with them, they begin to run. we don't have their speed, so all we can do is this hit-and-run type of tactic. But that's been successful in keeping them from killing whales for about a total of 15 days in the last month.
Explain why it is that you are where you are.
This is the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary in Japan's in violation of the International Whaling Commission regulations by whaling here. They're also in violation of the global moratorium on commercial whaling because this is a commercial whale hunt. They're also targeting fin whales, which are an endangered species protected by the CITES, or Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species. And they're taking whales in the Antarctic, Antarctic Australian Territory, which is a violation of Australian law. In addition, they just refueled from the Oriental Bluebird, their supply boat, inside the Antarctic Treaty Area, which is another violation. So what we have is these Japanese whalers are in violation of numerous international laws and regulations, and that's why we're down here, to intervene against their illegal activities.
Paul, you take direct action. You're not prepared to stand by and allow these things to happen. Certainly, there in other arenas, for other causes, people take action, and that is something that you are prepared to do. And in many respects, you're putting, well, there's a danger to what you're doing. For example, there was an event on Sunday, and apparently you're prepared to continue to take a stand in defense of the whales.
Well, our position is that the Japanese whaling vessels, the seven vessels that are down here, are operating in violation of international conservation law, and we have to stop them. And if that means disabling them or damaging their equipment, then we're prepared to do that. People seem to forget that these are criminals. They're not just ordinary people out here trying to make a living. They're no different than drug dealers or bank robbers. And so that's why we're taking the action that we're doing. It doesn't do any good to just take their picture and stand around and hold protest signs. I mean, Greenpeace is trying to do their best, and they're limited by their, the tactics that they're allowed to do. And I'm glad they're down here. But we need to be more aggressive if we're going to actually put an end to this.
The Japanese claim that what they're doing is part of their research. They suggest that the process of taking these whales is something that they do in order to study and really advance the science of whales and cetaceans. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, it's totally bogus. That argument isn't even accepted by the Scientific Committee of the International Whaling Commission. This research whaling ends up in sushi bars all over Japan. Last year they made $250 million. They've now doubled their quota. They'll make close to $500 million, and they want to take even more next year. This is a commercial enterprise, and they're not fooling anybody by saying it's research. And they haven't even got permission to do this research from the International Whaling Commission. And you don't kill whales in a whale sanctuary as part of research. Also, they're in violation of rules that they're not allowed to take fin whales at any time, any place, for research or for any other reason. So this is a bogus argument. We don't buy it, and nobody else does either.
Now, you've had direct confrontations with the...
The Nishin Maru is the factory vessel for the Japanese whaling fleet.
Correct. And on Sunday, you actually had what the people are referring to as a side-swiping incident. How did that come about? How did you make that decision to take that action?
Well, on Sunday, we saw the Nishin Maru transloading whale meat to the Oriental Bluebird. And as we approached, the Nishin Maru threw off its lines and disengaged itself from the Oriental Bluebird and backed up. And as it did so, it collided with the Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise, and then sped off, and we were in pursuit. We tried to follow the propellers of the Nishin Maru by sending zodiacs ahead and putting lines in front of them. But they were able to get away and started running. The next day, the next morning, we intercepted the Oriental Bluebird, the supply vessel. I ordered them out of the whale sanctuary. They refused to answer me, so I sideswiped them to get their attention and then ordered them out again, and they began to run.
Now, how do you communicate? Is this by a bullhorn, or is it by radio phone?
We communicate through the VHF radio, but there's not been much communication. The Japanese don't answer.
There's really quite a bit of action. As you mentioned, the Greenpeace vessels now have actually been... There's a dispute as to what the story is, but certainly Greenpeace is suggesting that the Nishin Maru literally set out to collide with them. It wasn't a totally serious impact. Front end of the Arctic Sunrise was damaged. Did you actually witness that incident?
Yeah, we witnessed the entire incident, and, Greenpeace is saying that the Nishin Maru rammed them, and the Japanese are saying Greenpeace rammed them. What actually happened is when the Nishin Maru disengaged from the Oriental Bluebird to get away from us, they backed up and hit the Arctic Sunrise. They collided with the Arctic Sunrise, and I think that was negligence on the part of the captain of the Nishan Maru, but I don't think they deliberately rammed it.
Well, how are things proceeding today? Every day seems to be a new adventure. For example, there has been discussion that the Japanese may intervene militarily. What are you hearing about that?
Well, there's some talk about sending the so-called airborne police down after us. I don't know what they're going to do, take our fishers or strafe us, but it seems a little useless to send airplanes down here. They're not going to be able to land. So I don't know exactly what they're going to do, but Japan can do whatever they want. But the fact is that this is an illegal operation, and we're not going to retreat on it because of Japanese bullying. You know, if these were Indonesian or fishing vessels, Australia would be all over them, and rightfully so. But because Japan's a wealthy nation, the message that Australia is sending is, you do what you want. We're not going to interfere with you. The fact is they're in violation of Australian law by killing whales in the Australian Antarctic territory. And Australian law would intercept. For instance, they go after a Patagonia tooth fishermen down here who are fishing, and they're no different than the Japanese whalers.
The Australians have suggested they may send out vessels to witness what's going on, as well as the New Zealand, I believe, has done the same. Have you seen any action from them?
Well, I've been requesting that Australia send out a naval vessel to witness what's going on, and they've refused. And I know New Zealand's mentioned it, but they actually said yesterday they're not going to do it. What we have down here are 7 vessels of the whaling fleet, 2 Greenpeace ships, and a Sea Shepherd vessel. So all told, there's 11 vessels down here, and it's a high seas chase. We've already covered over 4,000 nautical miles from south of New Zealand all the way to almost to the south of South Africa.
Now, how long do you expect that you can actually be out there? Do you have the option to refuel, or do you have enough to carry on?
Well, we're good for about 3 more weeks of fuel. And, you know, at some point we're going to have to refuel. The Japanese have the advantage. They just refueled. They sent a tanker down here to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of money to be made for killing whales, and there's not very much money available to save them. So we're at a serious disadvantage there.
So how do you see days ahead here? This sounds like it's just going to keep on going.
Yeah, we can do what we do for as long as we can do it with the resources we have. Right now, I'm also looking ahead to next year. We've got to come back here with a faster ship. I think we found the key to stopping them. If I can get a vessel that can keep up with the Nishan Maru, I pretty much can guarantee they won't kill any whales.
What do you need?
Just a fast ship.
We'll see what we can do. Anybody listening who happens to have a fast... How big a boat is, by the way, the Farley Moat?
We're about 48 meters. And it's a former Norwegian research vessel, so it's an undersea trawler design.
I hear you're in the process of thinking this may be time to, as you say, find something new.
Yeah, we got to get a faster vessel if we're going to be effective against this whaling fleet. This plan by the Japanese is a 17-year plan to kill whales and increase the number every year. Next year they want to take 50 humpbacks in addition to another 50 fin whales, and also probably up the number of pike whales or minke whales. So, you know, this is going to be a long-term campaign, and if we can get down here and stop them, I think we could probably put an end to it. I'm sure it's going to escalate. I'm sure the government of Japan probably might send down the police or whatever, and that's all fine with us. Let's make a big deal about it. Let's expose the fact that this is a blatantly illegal operation. You know, people call us pirates, but I don't really have a problem with that. If you go back to the 1600s to the Caribbean, it wasn't the British Navy that shut down piracy. They were too busy taking bribes. Piracy was shut down by by Henry Morgan, who was a pirate. So sometimes you need pirates to stop pirates.
Paul, what drives you to do all this?
Well, you know, we're losing species on this planet at an incredible rate. And, you know, I'm a firm believer in the laws of ecology, the law of diversity, interdependence, and finite resources. And we're going to get to a point where we remove one too many species on this planet and the whole ecosystem is going to collapse. And so really what we're doing is not just for whales, but also for people, for our own survival. The health of the oceans is very much a cornerstone to life surviving on land. And the oceans are dying, as Jacques Cousteau said just before he died. The oceans are dying in our time, and we've got to do everything we can to protect them. Every single commercial fishery seems to be in a state of collapse. Human greed is wiping out everything. And so we've got to put the brakes on this, and so that's why we're down here, to try and stop this. You know, one thing that Sea Shepherds are unique in is that we're not a protest organization. We don't protest anything. We simply intervene against illegal activities, and we have the authority to do so by virtue of the United Nations World Charter for Nature that states very specifically that non-governmental organizations and individuals are empowered to uphold international conservation law. We're doing the job down here that governments like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and others should be doing but are not. If they were here, we wouldn't have to be here.
One can only hope that somehow we'll get to the point where this becomes the priority that it needs to be. In terms of the Japanese, one has to wonder why they continue to do this. Obviously, it's for the sushi bars, which is a shame all by itself that whales should be slaughtered in order to keep people happy in a sushi bar. Beyond that, what other uses are the Japanese putting the whales to? Why is this so important to them?
It's exclusively a meat market. That's really all it is, and the Japanese believe that, you know, they have a right to do this. In addition to doing this, they're killing 20,000 dolphins every year, spearing and stabbing them to death on the beaches of Japan. I had two of my crew members went to jail for 3 weeks 2 years ago, including my wife, for diving into the bay and cutting the ropes to release the dolphins. And so, you know, Japan just feels that everything in the ocean is there to be consumed. When they run out of fish and everything in their own waters, they scour the rest of the planet to take what they want.
How would you recommend that people help your organization or even taking their own action?
Well, you know, people can get onto our website at seashepherd.org and get all that information. And we're establishing Sea Shepherd in Australia. We're opening up an office in Melbourne this month.
And then in terms of empowering people, how would you get someone to take their own actions? How should they be inspired by your actions?
Well, I think that everybody has a duty and a responsibility to make sure that we protect this planet for our children and our children's children, make this a better world for tomorrow. And so, you know, people should just be very cognizant of their, you know, their own consumption, what they consume, and keep in mind where things come from. The fish that's taken out of the ocean, what are the ecological costs of removing that fish? You know, if people were more aware of where things come from, I think that might be a step in the right direction.
Now, have you taken any actions against bottom dredgers?
In fact, 2 weeks ago while we were down here, we found a long line set by a Uruguayan vessel to catch Patagonia toothfish. We confiscated that line. Every year we confiscate hundreds of miles of long lines that we find in the ocean. Earlier in 2005, we set net rippers off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. These are devices that are meant to ensnare the bottom drag trawlers and rip their nets open. Last year, we also dove in and cut open the nets in the Galapagos National Park of tuna vessels that were fishing illegally in the national park and released, I think at one point, we released 10 tons of tuna. But so we've taken a very aggressive action against illegal fishermen over the last few years.
You really do take direct action. I'm just curious how often you've gotten to the point where you just kind of wonder if you're going to really make it through a particular moment. This sounds as if a lot of tensions could be manifest right in your face.
Yeah, we've been arrested a few times. Canada's arrested me for interfering with drag trawling operations, but we've gone to court and I was acquitted under the charges. I find it really strange that the governments are so concerned about defending illegal fishing operations. Ultimately, we're going to win in the court because we're acting, I think, rightfully in accordance to the UN Charter for Nature. That was my defense on that court case, and the jury agreed with me. But it seems that the government spent a lot of time protecting the interests of illegal operations, like illegal whaling and illegal fishing. It must be, there certainly is a lot of money involved, and that money is changing hands someplace.
Well, we're hearing a lot about illegal transfer of money right now in the United States, which is nothing new. It's just coming to the surface right now. You take many different forms of action. You have quite a wild, I mean that in a positive way, itinerary for moving around the planet. Where are you headed next? What are some of your plans for the 2006?
Well, we have a full-time patrol vessel in the Galapagos National Park. We're working in a partnership with the Galapagos National Park to protect the Marine Reserve. We've intercepted and arrested 56 poachers in the last few years. And we've opened an office in the Galapagos, so we're there on a permanent basis. We're also protecting and working with the rangers of Mapello Island National Park off of Colombia, Cocos Island National Park off of Costa Rica, and Fernando de Noronha National Park off of Brazil. And last year I was invited by the president of Senegal to come meet with him at Dakar to talk about what can be done about illegal fishing. And we'll be going up to Mozambique. We've been invited by the government of Mozambique to come up and try and off pirate fishing operations in their waters. So we're actually now getting requests from governments for assistance in trying to deal with illegal fishing activity.
It sounds as if a lot of your work actually is in internationally or nationally dedicated preserves, and that you work to defend them. Are you finding that there really aren't defense mechanisms to defend those areas put up by national and international agencies?
There seems to be a lack of political will, and certainly a lack of money to go in and protect everything from World Heritage sites to national parks to sanctuaries. They all look good on paper, and they look fine on the map, but pretty much all of the world's sanctuaries and national parks are being exploited by poachers. And so it's become a crisis, really, because as fisheries collapse in other areas, they're moving into these sanctuaries where the fish have had refuge in order to get them there. There's simply not enough fish in the world's oceans to continue to feed the ever-expanding populations of humanity. That's the bottom line. And we're going to wipe them out if we continue to do what we're doing.
That is what's happening. That's what you're taking the stand to do, is to keep this entire system from collapsing. And in many respects, it is already in collapse quite massively in some areas. What's the future of whales now, from your perspective, in terms of trying to expand again even greater protection for species around the world?
Well, unless we stop this Japanese whaling fleet from doing what they're doing, they're going to increasingly increase the numbers they're taking, and so the future's not looking very good for the whales. And, you know, whales are different than most other species that we deal with. I mean, here we're dealing with one of the most intelligent, most socially complex creatures on the planet. These are, you know, not sardines. You know, the biggest brain that's ever been developed on any animal on the planet, including our own, is the cetacean brain. And, you know, where, for instance, to give you an idea, the human brain has a capacity of 1,300 cubic centimeters, but the sperm whale has 9,000 cubic centimeters, the orca 6,000 cubic centimeters. And these are big animals, but when you consider dinosaurs are big animals and have brains the size of walnuts, the fact is big brains mean something. And I think these animals are incapable of incredible communication abilities with each other. And that one day, I think through the use of computers, we might even be able to communicate with them. But instead, what we're doing is wiping them out.
What are you looking forward to today, and how do you actually spend your day?
Well, it's been one big car chase, really, except for using ships. But we've been chasing them for 4,000 miles, and we're continuing to chase them. As long as we have them on the run, they're not killing whales. Mm. And they'll stop probably in a day or so and start whaling again, and we'll catch up with them, and then they'll run again.
So, I mean, for example, are you actually in pursuit right now?
Yes, we are. We're right now heading along the coast of Antarctica. We're probably around 65 degrees longitude.
And do you actually see some of these vessels?
No, they're way ahead of us. You know, they're faster than we are. We have to catch up with them each time.
Now, how do you know how do you know where to go? How do you know where to find them?
Well, I can't really say, but I know exactly where the Nishan Maru is at any moment.
Fair enough. Okay. This is proprietary.
Yeah.
Paul Watson, I want to thank you for taking this time, calling us via satellite phone from the Farley Moat in the Antarctic regions in defense of the world's greatest creatures, the whales. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk soon again, and feel free, contact your people to contact me if there's ever a reason that I can help you and to bring updates on your mission.
Okay, well, thank you. I just want to add that this is one of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, we're passing icebergs down here the size of cities. I think we must have passed 10,000 of them in the last 3 weeks.
You're posting a lot of information, a lot of actually photographs and videos, and there's an update. Why don't you give that website?
It's Sea Shepherd, SeaShepherd.org, SeaShepherd.org.
And what's the temperature like there out on the ocean?
Well, it's the summertime down here, so it's about...
That's true. That's true. I forgot about that.
The summertime in Antarctica is about 32 degrees on average. Nice. On New Year's Day, though, my crew all jumped in with bathing suits into the ocean, and it was 27 degrees.
Hey, that's not for me. I'm glad someone like you and your people can do that. Someday, hopefully, I'll be able to join you on your ship, and we'll do some in-depth.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This saga is ongoing as we speak, and the clanging of ships' hulls may be a clarion call about the clashes that are likely to continue in this new year. You will always be informed by staying tuned in to your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.